Good evening, everyone. My name's Nick Bisley. I'm the Dean of Humanities and Social Sciences here at La Trobe University, and it gives me great pleasure to invite you, or invite you to welcome you, because you've already been invited and you've made it to the city campus for the launch of the Australia-Japan Foundation report. That's also a report supported by the FCDO from the UK, and it's a collaboration between King's College London, La Trobe University, and Kyushu University in Japan. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the lands on which we're gathered, the Wurundjeri Woi-wurrung people, and pay my respects to elders past and present, and acknowledge their enduring connection to land and country. We all know in the past 6 months or so, the business of reconciliation has proved to be a much longer slog and steeper path than we might have hoped. But here at La Trobe, we're committed to playing our part, both in driving reconciliation, but also advancing public debate and understanding of that. My job is to do a few things, essentially to act as master of ceremonies and guider of the conversation, and ensure particularly that Alessia remembers that order and justice both need to live in a degree of harmony. But before we begin the conversation to talk about the issues that we cover in the report, I'd like to introduce Professor Theo Farrell, who I think we can still say is our new vice chancellor at La Trobe University. At some point, we'll have to say he's just the vice chancellor, but we're thrilled to welcome him both to the university, but also Theo's on home turf, so to conceptually speaking, with a history and war studies as his academic specialty. So Theo, over to you.
Great. Thanks, Nick. Good evening, everyone, and good evening, everyone who's joined us online. So I'd like to also start by acknowledging we're meeting on the lands of the Wurundjeri people and pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and to any First Nations people that are with us in this room or joining us online. So it really is a genuine pleasure. It says here, it's a pleasure, but actually it's a genuine pleasure to be here today for this discussion. As Nick rightly pointed out, this is really a topic of great interest to me. I have to say, to give you an insight into the kind of what my day looks like, this is my third event that I've been launching or speaking at. The last one was the launch of three emus in our wildlife sanctuary, which was great fun. It was great fun.
What, the emus are back?
The emus are back, yeah. And we had big discussions around Gregory Peck, but it was great. But I'm really looking forward to the discussion tonight. So we are here to launch the 10th edition of La Trobe Asia's brief, Enhancing Global and Regional Maritime Order. Tonight's discussion brings together four panel members that will present research from a collaboration project between La Trobe Asia, Kyushu University, and my old university, King's College London. So I'd like to begin by welcoming our panel guests and contributors on behalf of the La Trobe community. So our own Professor Beck Stratting, Director of La Trobe Asia, my old friend, Professor Alessio Patilano, from King's College London Department of War Studies, Professor who's online, Professor Kyoto Hatakamayami.
Hatakiyama.
Thank you.
Hatakiyama.
Thank
It's
you.
hard to pronounce. Yeah.
I'll get there eventually. Who's from the Graduate School of International Studies and Regional Development, University of Niigata Prefecture. And our own Professor Nick Beasley, who's chairing this evening, the Dean of the School of Humanities and Social Sciences. This is really timely. So some of you who've been following the news will know about the recent announcement about Japan joining a closer integration in terms of the defense security cooperation with the United States and United Kingdom, the potential of including more closely Japan in the second pillar of the AUKUS partnership. I think what's really interesting about this brief is the focus on the regional maritime security order and the extent to which countries don't have shared understandings of what that order looks like. Now, at the best of times, it's quite difficult to get countries to come together and develop shared understandings. But when you've got an intensifying competition that has a military character to it in the region, then the challenge becomes even greater. And so here we are, trying to improve cooperation in the maritime domain at a time where there aren't shared understandings and where there's intensifying competition. And those are the challenges that are discussed in this report we discussed this evening. I also, by the way, want to just do a shout out for Beck's new book, Girth by Sea, because it too makes a really important point. And what we're seeing in the Australian debate, certainly, is this doubling down and focus on military security. We're going to build these new submarines and whatnot. And there's a lot of focus on that. Well, in fact, of course, I think what you argue in your book and in this report also explores are the various ways that we develop security, including through diplomacy, and the more holistic understanding of the various dimensions of security, environmental, health, and so forth. So I think this kind of discussion is really important to widen our lens as we think about security. I'm really looking forward to the discussion. Okay, I've blabbed on enough. Let me just say, before I conclude, I want to acknowledge, actually genuinely acknowledge, the Australia-Japan Foundation of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade and the United Kingdom Foreign and Commonwealth Development Office. We've got colleagues this evening from here. Thank you for the funding that they have provided to support the development of this project. Final plug is to say, if you're interested, please do sign up for the La Trobe Asia mailing list. Okay, I'm going to hand over to Nick now.
The mic down. Thanks, Darren. He set the scene, I think, fantastically for what we've been talking about, or what we will be talking about, and particularly, I think, underscored the salience of these issues. Gone are the days when we need people like me and Beck and Alessio needed to argue that we needed to take security in the region seriously and that great power competition was back and that markets and globalization were not going to save the day forever. We know great power competition is real. We know the friction in the region is acute and dangerous, and it feels like it's getting almost more dangerous by the day. And of course, the maritime domain is where that is most acute and most visible, and potentially, might argue, at its most risky. And in this report, we explore a whole range of different components of that increasingly risky domain, and more particularly talk about ways in which that can be managed, secured, and improved. So I guess we might start by throwing it back and just say, perhaps you were the architect, mastermind, grand strategist. You are our Sir Halfred Mackinder, so to speak, in this project. Why don't you provide us with a bit of sketches to, I guess, what started it? What was the idea? What was the motivation behind it? And what's the kind of problems that that the project is trying to chew over?
Oh, thank you, Nick. And thank you to all of you for joining us this evening. It's nice to attend these events and not chair them. So thank you, Nick, for taking on the chairing responsibility so that I could just chat on the panel. And thank you to our Vice Chancellor, Theo, for those opening remarks. I'm particularly grateful for the plug of the book. So that's very pleased to hear your thoughts on GERT by Sea. But to your question, Nick, this project was really a product of collaboration and partnership. Nick and I had an existing partnership with Chisako Masao and Nobuhiro Aizawa at Kyushu University, and that's been running for quite some time, since I think 2017, where we've done various things, various projects, looking at the contested nature of security order in East Asia. And running alongside that, La Trobe Asia has been collaborating with Alessio, my good friend Alessio here, and Hilary Briff, who is also based at King's College London. And we've been collaborating on issues of maritime security cooperation and maritime order within the broader Indo-Pacific. So partly the idea came from merging these two existing partnerships together in one way to form an academic trilateral between Japan, UK and Australia on maritime security in the Indo-Pacific. And I think this was around 2021, 2022 when we were putting together the grant application. I don't think we realised how kind of prescient it was actually now mentioned before, you know, JAUKUS, and we're thinking about the fact that Japan and Australia signed a reciprocal access agreement, and then the UK became the second state to sign that agreement. This was all sort of happening when we were formulating. This is all sort of happening while we were planning this cooperation, thinking about the ways in which three what we might call secondary powers could come together to try and support their maritime interests. And of course, all three states have critical maritime security interests. And Japan is Australia's most important strategic partner in Asia. I think the JAUKUS discussions really underline this incredible growth in cooperation between Australia and Japan. And then, as I was saying, the UK and Japan are also seeing this real growth in the relationship. But there's also these three states that have maritime characteristics or features in common. You know, UK and Japan are archipelagic states, and Australia has offshore archipelagos. They rely on sea lanes and choke points remaining open for trade. They have key interests in fisheries, and the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, remaining central to maritime order generally, is a very important part of UK, Japan, Australia's conceptualization of order. So there was this motivation to bring together what has often been quite two distinct sets of ideas or discussions or literatures, one around the kind of formation, the maintenance and the alteration of order, whether it's regional order in East Asia or whether it's international order more broadly, but also this other set of literature around maritime order and what constitutes good order at sea. And Alessio, I'm going to plug your book, The New Age of Naval Power in the Indo-Pacific, which precisely tries to bridge that divide between how we conceptualize regional and global order on the one hand and what that means for the maritime, and what the maritime also means for how order is changed, maintained, how it disintegrates. These are sort of the crucial questions of our time when we're thinking about Asian political landscape. So this was really an opportunity, I think, to try to conceptualize some of the theory, like central international relations theory around order, but it has a very important empirical role to play. And from our discussions, we had a workshop in at Kyushu University, a two-day workshop where we fleshed out some of these ideas of what maritime order consists of, how order is formulated, and what's actually happening not just in the seas of East Asia, but the Indo-Pacific more broadly, to try to kind of nut out this question of what maritime order is, how it can be sustained, and what it means for order much more generally. So in our discussion, we came up with three critical challenges facing maritime order in Asia. Theo, in your comments, you listed some of those challenges. First, the obvious one is that states actually hold different interpretations of maritime order. Sometimes I think when we listen to strategic narratives of particular states, it can sound as if they're all kind of on the same page. But when we dig in a little bit deeper, we can see that some of these states may not be as like-minded as we want to think that they are. And so while communities of practice within these states may share common language around maritime order, they may have differing ideas. They may have differing priorities about content, about governance, about stakeholders, or even different institutional capacities in trying to deal with issues of maritime order and how it is preserved, maintained, and so on. So that's the first sort of challenge. The second is in the context of great power competition, in the context of rising militarization, in the context of greater uncertainty, establishing a shared vision or a shared basis of regional maritime order through consensus building becomes much more challenging. And one of the important things I think about understanding Asia's security order more broadly is that the maritime is a really significant theatre for a strategic competition, and not just between the US and China, but rivalries that are occurring between states of this region. We can think of the South China Sea and the territorial and maritime disputes there. We can think about the East China Sea and, you know, for example, the disputes between between China and Japan over Senkaku Daio, for example. So it's becoming increasingly difficult to build a shared vision, an inclusive vision of order, particularly when one of the rising powers in the region, the People's Republic of China, is trying to carve out an exemption for itself, particularly within the South China Sea. And then there's a third issue of the great power, this kind of power politics context, making cooperation over security issues much more difficult for states. And this includes Australia, Japan, and the United Kingdom, but also other states in the Indo-Pacific region. And so what we hoped was, by analysing the nature of these broad challenges, we could then try to interrogate what the central issues are and provide some policy recommendations, some tangible and concrete policy recommendations for how these states might be better equipped to coordinate on issues of maritime security, but also how we might be able to advance an issue, a vision of maritime order where there is a kind of collective buy-in among states and leaders and strategic elites about the nature of that order.
Thanks, Beck. That's set up the questions I'm going to throw to you and to Alessio and Kyoko as we go through things. Of course, I should have said at the top, we'll make sure we leave some time for questions from the floor. Yeah. For those of you who want to know desperately more about Pillar 2 and potential Japanese involvement or whatever particular details you'd like to dig into. But why don't we start with the conceptual, though, that Theo flagged and you mentioned, Beck, about about order. And you know, it strikes me that order is a bit like supply chains. When you're talking about it, you've got problems. Yeah. When you're not talking about it, it's functioning.
Yeah.
And we're definitely in a point where, like supply chains and COVID, we're talking about order much more than we have done for decades in East Asia. So let's say, maybe you could start with a bit of a sketch of what the differing ideas are that are associated with maritime order and some of the challenges that these different concepts present.
Thank you, Nick. First of all, let me plug your book back into the conversation, just because we haven't done that enough. But you see, the point you were making at the beginning, that is nice for once not to chair so that you can sort of be engaged. 2 days ago, we were all in Canberra for a session which we did the book launch for Girth by Sea. And it was the first time in about 18 months that there was a significant panel on maritime security, maritime strategic discussion, and I was sitting in the audience. It was such a good feeling, because listening to such an in-depth conversation, it becomes also an opportunity to step back, think about your own work, and listen and sort of reflect upon things. So it's great to be part of a channel or panel, but I can tell you the other days when you guys were talking over there, it was very good not to be part of the panel so that you can sort of enjoy, listen, reflect, and just let everything sort of sink in. But to your point about order, I think let's go step by step. First step, I think it's very important to go back to something that you mentioned briefly, and that is the centrality of the maritime domain to the broader Indo-Pacific. Mind you, what we are discussing here obviously has the Indo-Pacific front and center, but it is applicable pretty much anywhere else where there's ocean that is part of a regional construct, whether it is the Mediterranean, whether it is the North Sea, whether it is the Gulf of Guinea. However, insofar as the Indo-Pacific broadly defined is concerned, it's very important to emphasize that regardless of where you place the boundaries of the Indo-Pacific, whether you do the artificial thing of the COCOMs in the US system, whereby Indo-PACOM command area of responsibility ends somewhere around Sri Lanka, as in like all of a sudden you step, you know, 2 miles off there, it's like, whoop, finished, right? That's no longer the Indo-Pacific. That actually doesn't matter. The key element in this is the role that the connecting role that the maritime domain has in the Indo-Pacific. So to the point that Beck raised earlier, when we're talking about order, or ordering principles in the Indo-Pacific, the maritime, because of its centrality and its connecting function to this region, then conversations about order inevitably take center stage and in a way are a very specific and very important sort of placing of the discourse over the security of a regional order in a way that is practical, in a way that is tangible, that is real, and in a way that is much better than the sort of short ends such as, you know, a rule-based international order. What does that mean? Well, in the Indo-Pacific, the first port of call of that notion is the maritime domain. And that's why we started with that, right? So the first point to make is that when we're talking about the Indo-Pacific, more than in any other place, regardless of the geographic sort of definition of the Indo-Pacific, the key element is that the centrality of the ocean in connecting, in being this glue that brings this broader space together, right, places issues and questions around order at the very center of it. The second point to make is that the diversity of views that exist over what order at sea means unfold from a transformation, I would say, of our relationship, the relationship that human beings and communities, states have with the sea itself. Because on the one hand, you have the sort of strategic dimension of the uses of the sea. The sea is a space in which states project power at sea and from across the sea to extend their reach. A common friend in the Royal Australian Navy, Sean Andrews, he always says that a ship makes you the neighbor of any country that is touched by the ocean. And in many ways, that is absolutely true. Because it reflects this long-standing engagement of states and with the sea to project power. That traditional understanding that is very hierarchical, because of course, the bigger, the larger your material capabilities, the more likely you are to project it to a greater extent the power of the states, has to be complemented nowadays. But what has emerged through the third conferences, in particular over the ocean and the sort of coming together of its proceedings in UNCLOS, a different understanding of the ocean. An ocean as a living entity, as a place where fish stock, seabed resources, this is a place that we need to protect. It plays that it's not, we're not just projecting power across this space, but as a living body that is essential for a sustainable future for humanity, we need to engage on through rights and responsibilities to protect, to responsibly access and exploit. And so these two things invite two slightly different dimensions of the conversation over order. One that is very much strategic, and it's very hierarchical, and it's about the projection of material power. And the other one that is much more normative. It is not so much about the projection of power, but the capacity to engage, interact, and use the ocean. One is about hierarchical sort of structures, because depending on your material capabilities, you will impose your capacity to use that space more or less. The other one is about governance, and how you manage to sort of define your space of sovereignty and sovereign rights in particular, right, to exercise that governance. And unfortunately, this leads to the third point about this tension between these different understanding of order. Part of the big differences that we noted in terms of what maritime security should be about and what sort of ideas of orders sort of are connected to that relates to the fact that in the Indo-Pacific, certainly over the last sort of 10, 15 years, the attempts at projecting sovereign rights in the maritime domain, whether in the East China Sea or in the South China Sea or in other sub-theaters of the broader Indo-Pacific theater, have been presented as ancillary to that broader strategic function of projection. And so ultimately you have things such as the artificial military outposts in the South China Sea that become a point of convergence of a way of ascertaining your sovereign rights in a contested space to support it, which, however, is also the brainchild of that broader strategic function of projection of the power of the states, which is the only way you can explain how the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in China, they'll tell you that lighthouses in the middle of the South China Sea need to come with pointed defense systems and long-range missile strikes. Did you know that? I did not know that. That public goods are better provided if you put a missile next to it, so I'm told. And so I think these three points are, for me, something that really emerged in this conversation. So this idea that we have to start with where the Indo-Pacific as a maritime regional security complex sort of starts off, this idea of these two different notions, extremes of this spectrum of the understanding of borders, and how, unfortunately, the governance element over the past few years has been more victim of that strategic dimension, certainly when it comes to some of the actors in the region.
And excuse me, but it also seems to me that there's a fundamental tension between a lot of the ideas around order, which tend to be sort of tend to come out of kind of conventional thinking around international politics, which tend to be kind of deeply territorial. You know, that sovereignty can be, you know, lined up, you're on one side or the other, the flag flies here or nowhere else, and all of these things that follow from it when you're thinking in territorial terms. But the maritime domain is really slippery, pardon the pun. I mean, it's quite complex and has a range of layered dimensions to it, which actually don't allow that kind of mapping of the territorial. And I know, Beck, you've written a little bit about efforts by some states in the region to try to territorialize the seas. You want to say a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. And you're right. And actually, when I was preparing my notes, I was going to write exactly that point about how international order, particularly conceived of by international relations as a discipline, is often very terrestrial, and it rubs up against a maritime order, and that's part of the challenge in combining these two sets of ideas, you know, kind of international order more broadly and maritime order, and bringing them together is the fact that sovereignty and international law of how states go about acquiring territory is quite different from the rules that are set out under the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. And one of the things that UNCLOS does in trying to resolve or try to create ways of sorting out who gets what in the maritime domain, it relies on an assumption that sovereignty is settled. Mm-hmm. So you can say, oh, this state owns this, and therefore we can carve out maritime zones based on that. But unfortunately, the sovereignty is not always settled, or we've got states building more bits of land trying to assert sovereignty over them and then potentially trying to claim maritime zones under that, which that is not legal under UNCLOS. But you have this kind of problem of different international legal orders that don't necessarily work in kind of complementary ways. And then the territorialization, what we mean by that is the ways that states try to assert control over maritime areas in ways they do land. So, you know, we have this idea of the seas. A lot of the world, you know, 70% of the planet is ocean, and a lot of that is high seas, and high sea is supposed to be a global commons. But what we see increasingly, and not just China in the South China Sea, but other states as well, is they're trying to encroach on that idea of the seas of the global commons, try to extend their security jurisdictions further and further out into these maritime domains. But I would say that the South China Sea is one of the sort of examples of maritime territorialization, because the Nine Dash Line plays an important, it provides an interesting example of territorialization, because you've got this kind of map that China's leaders are a bit ambiguous about. It seems like there's not a clear line in Beijing about what the map actually is supposed to, what they're claiming, but through that map. But it's becoming increasingly used in popular culture. Like, you know, now we're seeing maps with the nine dash line, and Southeast Asian states are protesting it when it appears on TV shows and in media. Barbie, I mean, I never thought I would be talking about Barbie on the ABC, but thanks to the nine dash line map, I was last year. So these are ways in which China seeks to project the idea that the South China Sea is not just maritime area, but it's an exceptional area that should be under the control, the domestic jurisdiction and control of China. There are other ways of doing this, like naming rocks and shoals and underwater features, creating administrative divisions, creating laws, using coast guards to then try to enforce some of those domestic laws. These are all ways of trying to assert control over maritime area that actually doesn't really fit that well with a maritime order that is centered not just on UNCLOS, but a longer spread of international law focused on the idea of free seas, kind of Grotian idea of the free seas. So they're interesting dynamics, but it's taking place within that broader context of strategic competition, I think, as well.
I want to change gears a little bit because we've been talking at a sort of fairly macro level. And of course, we get a lot of press about the flashpoints of the region. You mentioned the South China Sea, the East China Sea disputes, Taiwan, of course. But it's also, these are pretty busy waterways for fishing, enormous amounts of international trade flows through the seaways. And so just managing that on a day-to-day basis is itself challenging. So Kyoko, I wanted to bring you in and ask, if you could talk a little bit about the sort of complex jurisdictional issues, and in particular, what are the challenges for sort of managing both the sort of mundane, if you like, day-to-day challenges, as well as the more complex crises that can emerge in this pretty busy maritime space?
Yes, so actually, as you know, we face the US-China competition in the maritime domain, and can you hear me?
Yes, that's perfect.
And yes, so that has also based on the different interpretation of UNCLOS, and also that is a strategic competition. But there are many other issues to be addressed in the region. For instance, illegal fishing is used by China as a tool to establish control over the sea by dispatching fishing vessels, which are protected by government vessels. China is trying to strengthen its control over the sea. So Chinese ships also conduct a gray zone activity, which is not an attack, but aggressive behavior, creating a situation that falls between war and peace. So resource development also leads to a new confrontation between China that claims almost the entire South China Sea and littoral states, resulting in a small confrontation. And so piracy has also presented a threat to commercial ships passing through the sea. So except for piracy, resource development, or illegal fishing, China's growth, gray zone strategy are caused by the different interpretation of UNCLOS. So there are many issues we need to solve. However, I want to say that these issues are quite difficult to be solved. So I suggest to, if we cooperating with each other by eliminating piracy in the region, that would bring us, get together. Because elimination of piracy is a relatively easy area to promote cooperation for the regional states, even though they do not necessarily share the same view about the regional order or about the, interpretation of the international law. So because it is clear that piracy threatens the safety of sea lands. So such cooperation should include, of course, all states in the region, including China. So yeah, there are many issues, but maybe except for piracy, it is very difficult to resolve these problems. But if we focus on piracy, that is a sort of day-to-day troubles, that is also a serious threat to our everyday life, because that affects the commercial shipping. But regarding piracy, maybe we can resolve the issue quite easily. Thank you.
Thanks, Griffin. Alessia.
I was going to say that the Kyoko raises a very good point when thinking about piracy as an opportunity sort of to come together, because what sits behind this idea is that, and in a way what also emerged as we were compiling this piece of research, is that the transnational type of challenge in the context of maritime stability and maritime security, it's in a way slightly easier to address it, because it doesn't sort of imply or requires a preliminary agreement over where you do something in a way that it speaks to sovereign rights. Because at sea, and this is something that Beck, you also mentioned in a way implicitly, but perhaps let's dwell on it for a second. Fundamentally, when you were referring to the question of the difference between the land and the sea, and how you translate sovereignty on land and at sea you don't own the sea, right? You have very privileged rights over what's in it in certain portions of it. So there's a functional understanding of sovereignty. And that's really where you have that sort of tension when we talk about the territorialization. The vocabulary itself implies that you're transforming the sea into an extension of the land, which is conceptually and doctrinally, in that sense, wrong. And I've always been sort of very keen to push back towards, and we discussed this and we agree on this question that territorialization is a very dangerous vocabulary when you start deploying, because you're buying into the sort of Chinese approach of ownership of the space, right? And the way, for example, on the nine dashed line, on many of the publications, the way in which the Chinese sort of publicly talk about the South China Sea without clarifying necessarily what it is. But if you remember, there's a Bill Hader's famous point about the pictures in China. Where does China end in the South China Sea? And you look at it, it's a picture, it's a blue picture. So, did I step the other side, right? Because there is this tendency to use concepts and vocabulary that speaks to the land. And so avoiding, however, in place where that is contested, how you pursue, why do we notice the challenges in cooperation in aspects of maritime security? Because depending on what particular aspects of it you're looking after, whether it is sort of the monitoring of fishery patrol, for example, well, it's a great thing. But if you don't have an agreed boundary delimitation of EEZs, you can only do it on the high seas, because otherwise, the moment that we disagree on drawing the boundary, but I do accept that you will conduct a particular fishery patrol in that space, I'm also implicitly risking of conceding into that claim, because as you were saying, it's not just about UNCLOS, but it is also all the sets of codes and principles that are based on customary law, which in international public law, the sea do apply. And so the point that Kyoko was making, which I think is very essential, one of the challenges in cooperation these days on maritime security is how to find places to cooperate that do not implicitly or overtly reinforced contesting claims that are based on these sovereign rights. And in that sense, perhaps that was also what we noticed, that one of the findings, that cooperation is becoming more difficult, because it's kind of like harder to check, like, all right, so if I say yes to this, am I actually risking of conceding my own claim in that space in regards to that particular manifestation of sovereign rights to someone else's?
Do you want to add something quickly?
Only that I would see territorialization, and this might be getting into a very obscure sort of academic discussion now. I would see territorialization as a discourse that critiques the practice of territorialization. So using territorialization is not supposed to advocate that as a strategy.
I wanted to draw our attention to a point you made at the top Beck, and that is the role of middle powers, second ranking powers, regional powers. We can, whatever sticker you want to put on them. But you know, there's a tendency, I think, when we talk about the region, international politics, to focus understandably on the US and China, the sort of great power dynamics, and almost feel as if the whole thing is just the US, a Beijing Washington story, and the rest of us just, they make the waves, we surf them, drown in them, call it what you will, but we don't have a whole lot of scope. But actually in the report, what is explored is actually the possibilities for agency and the influence that middle powers can play. So I thought I might get you to start just with some thoughts about the scope for agency and how much influence, not just room for maneuver, but how much influence powers can have, and what is it that they need to do to activate that?
Yeah, I think it's always an important point to make when we're talking about something like the South China Seas, that the US doesn't have maritime and territorial claims in an area like the South China Sea. It has other interests, but these are disputes that are between China and between Southeast Asian countries, Vietnam, Philippines, Malaysia, Brunei, have I missed one? Indonesia, maybe. And that,
don't forget, Taiwan is a claimant in South China
Sea. We always do forget that Taiwan and yes, in and Senkaku DAO DAU Tai, DAU Tai, as well. So these are disputes that are actually between a rising or a great power in the region and smaller powers. And so the question of agency is really, I think, significant, because these countries are trying to defend their sovereignty, their sovereign rights within their legally claimed exclusive economic zones and continental shelves. And we in Australia and in the United Kingdom and in Japan rely on having good relationships with other states in the region. So it's really important to have agency, I think, at the heart of these discussions. Of course, great power competition is a significant sort of structural condition that states need to grapple with. But they are not the only part of the story. And in fact, when we were doing some of our collaborative work on contested security in East Asia, we were writing op-eds on the importance of secondary powers like Australia and Japan in being able to promote a vision of order, or being able to shape a regional order in ways that these states see as being favourable. So, it's not just about the great powers. And I think that there are roles to play for regional powers in promoting consensus on some of the norms and rules to try and to ameliorate maritime tensions, on dealing with or brokering new negotiations or new norms. So we talk about norm entrepreneurship as part of middle power diplomacy, for example, in brokering sort of new norms to be able to grapple with emerging or even old issues. I mean, Kyoko's point about piracy, I think, is critical, but there are a range of challenges that regional powers can kind of bring to the table in the maritime domain. Plastics, dealing with plastics, dealing with pollution, dealing with things like food security, sustainability, the bleaching of coral reefs, so the all of this sort of these issue areas. There's plenty of issue areas that don't necessarily touch the high politics of great power competition, that, are less politically sensitive, but also meet the needs of smaller and middle powers in the region. So I think regional powers can have a really strong role to play in engaging in capacity building efforts. I mean, Australia, Japan, and the United Kingdom already do this in things like enhancing maritime domain awareness or in Coast Guard training, particularly in the case of Japan in Southeast Asia. The risk is, though, that these states are doing it in a very uncoordinated way. They're not always aware of what capacity building efforts other states are undertaking, and that's one of the recommendations that we raise in the report is having a more coordinated approach to these efforts and really, I guess, trying to advance what some of the, you know, these smaller and middle power states, for example, in Southeast Asia or even in the Pacific or Indian Ocean, what they say is being their critical maritime security issues, which often isn't, you know, China. It can be illegal fishing, piracy, terrorism, slavery at sea, these sorts of governance issues that Alessio was talking about before. So having an expanded or a more holistic sense of what maritime security is also opens up opportunities for states to have a role in trying to shape regional order. Maybe we could see it from a kind of bottom-up perspective, perhaps.
I want a very big word on this. In a way, that's also why we talk about good order at sea to serve the broader purpose of governance, because good order at sea is about addressing the in a practical sense an existing challenge. It's not about complying to existing practices, but empowering the medium, small, local coastal states or coalition of coastal states to develop their own voice, their own practice. You know, there is no one definitive way to do something, so long so it does not undermine the broader normative context that underwrites the governance piece. But at the same time, there is no need to comply to one specific sort of format. The fact that it is pursued in other regions of the world is absolutely fine. But if locally, say, for example, street patrols around the Straits of Malacca, or indeed other type of initiatives that see the local coastal states coming together, finding an ad hoc practice that addresses the questions, to me seems a very important point in terms of guaranteeing that voices are heard and practices are inclusive. And eventually what you really are addressing is that sense of good order at sea that serves the broader question of governance. Is this a point where we can talk about Pillar 2 now? Enough with this stuff of governance.
We'll wait to see if you get a Dorothy Dixer from the crowd. One final thing I wanted to just touch on, and I'll ask each of you just to say a few quick things in response, and then I would like to leave some time for questions from the floor. And that's, you know, one of the region's, I think, biggest problems, both at sea and on land, is a lack of consensus about just the nature of the critical security issues that the region faces. And there seems to be a real inability to find common ground. And indeed, you know, at times what seems to be like overt unwillingness to take other states at their word. So to ask a perhaps slightly provocative question is, how much room do you think there actually is to build consensus about critical issues in maritime security in the region? Kyoko, I might start with you on that one. So how much room do we have to build consensus?
Actually, I don't think there are much room for common consensus, especially in strategic interests. However, if we look at governance area, it might be more easier for us to find a common ground. For example, such as the safety of sea lanes. So we all states, including China, the United States, Australia, Japan, all states have, you know, shared interest in the safety of sea lanes. So if we put the national interests aside and then focusing on the safety of sea lanes or governance area, we may be able to find a common ground. And also, you know, for example, we could patrol the area and conduct joint training by Coast Guard, not the military, Navy, and then create a framework for cooperation by Coast Guard. We may be able to, you know, cross the gap and then reach the common ground. So sharing practices may be able to promote common understanding in the area of governance, not strategic competition. So maybe we better focus on the safety of sea lanes.
That's a no, but take that. That's good. Beck.
I was going to say the same thing, but I think it's important to say that we talk a lot about China's assertions in the South China Sea and East China Sea, and there's a good reason why we talk about those tactics. But consensus is difficult because we're not just dealing with one great power that wants to carve out an exemption for itself in international law. We're talking about two, and that is that the United States has not ratified the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, which also makes it difficult to build consensus because even though, you know, US leaders will say, well, we follow it on the basis of customary law, in the strategic narratives, China says, well, you know, why should we be taught, you know, why, how can the US come out and be a maritime hegemon when it doesn't even follow, it doesn't even sign itself up to the rules of UNCLOS? So that, I think, is another dimension that makes consensus challenging because if the US isn't signed up, it kind of undermines the legitimacy of the whole project. And I'm not sure that all states are convinced by the US's, well, we follow it as a matter of custom because, you know, the US criticised China for not following the 2016 arbitral tribunal ruling with the case that the Philippines initiated against China. But, you know, the US has exempted itself from those legal mechanisms that are outlined in UNCLOS as well. So that's another issue, I think, in that's a bit gloomy. I'm supposed what I would say is that, yes, that's difficult, but I agree 100% with Kyoko that what we do need to look at is specific issue areas, and sea lanes is one. The other one is things like emerging points of contention under international law. How do we, for example, deal with the issue of rising sea levels and climate change and how that might affect maritime boundaries? How do we deal with drones and underwater, unmanned underwater vehicles? Are they classified as warships? You know, there are these sorts of issues that really need some clarifying, and in getting together to try to clarify some of those, you know, you might build a basis of cooperation. There's also the issue of confidence building measures. Sometimes I wonder whether confidence building measures is a bit kind of old fashioned.
Have you seen that?
I don't know. What is this? The cobble? Yeah, I know. So maybe I'm nostalgic by talking about confidence building measures, but we're talking about communication channels. You know, as we see incidents at sea in the airspace, you know, unsafe maneuvers and these kind of moments where vessels and aircraft are coming into close contact with each other. You want these channels of communication to avoid a conflict being sort of unwillingly sparked. Yeah. And I think that states, you know, have a role to play in trying to keep those channels of communication open.
Well, my kids are discovering acid wash jeans and Spandau ballet, so.
Yeah,
old as you. It's your I'll go in a slightly different direction because I decided I want to be disruptive now. I'm going to go all pillar two on this one, in act, if not in the name. So I do think that there is an enormous amount of scope for consensus if we accept that competition, contestation, and cooperation are bound to continue to coexist. And it's absolutely fine because at sea, concentration of forces does not exist in a way it does on land. So from my perspective, we need to sort of like the best way to look at the answer in a positive sense, because otherwise we end in the same very impressive space. It's like, oh my God, there's no way this is going to be a positive answer. But I think you can turn it around once you start accepting that we live in we're coming back to what has always been the main reality of the oceans. The oceans are volatile when states come into contact with each other. And we kind of, you know, we were kidding ourselves for the better part of 20 years when, you know, we were all sort of Coca-Cola advertisements, like it's not a piracy and we're all going to deal with it together. The truth is that was the exception to the rule. Now we're back to what the normality is. So if we take that, I think consensus actually becomes possible. And from my perspective, in addition to what's been mentioned already, by far the most important, urgent, and in a way it's a byproduct of climate change and sea level rises, it's natural disasters. Mm-hmm. And I think it is not a coincidence that in the very long joint statement coming out of the White House earlier on today in the Japanese visit in D.C., the working together to establish an operational capacity to deploy quickly to meet the challenge of natural disasters. That's one of the places where you can easily build the consensus and sort of created as an open architecture whereby everybody can bring whatever it is that they can and they will to. Because if there's the one thing that is for sure, oh God, I'm turning very negative here now. All right, hang on. All right, stay with me, okay? The key thing that we tend to forget is that all the data out there, and there are studies from about 70 years ago the UN compiled, by far the greatest source of loss of life, loss of property, displacement of people and disasters for societies in this part of the world has been natural disasters. And all the trends suggest that these are going to be more frequent, more destructive, and more disruptive as a result of both. So from my perspective, absolutely there is an opportunity for consensus. That rewards the agency of the non-major powers because that's a core interest that everybody has. And then becomes, if you make it sit next to the fact that competition and contestation will continue to exist, then we have a very sort of bright light ahead to look at.
All right, we have just a few minutes for questions here and then there, where we might. And if you keep questions short and sharp, please.
We saw in Europe, the Americans joined with EU and NATO to contain Russia, and that's been a great success. We see now in the Asia Pacific, the Americans joining with the Philippines, Japan, Australia, Korea to contain China. How do we expect we're going to get a different result?
I don't think you can. I would perhaps slightly disagree with the premise. I don't think that what is happening in this part of the world is just about containment of China. That's a gross sort of misrepresentation of the variety of different mechanisms. You know, Japan doing long-standing, multi-months deployments in Southeast Asia for capacity building, of course, will have an element of political signaling towards China. But at the same time, it doesn't change the fact that they're doing capacity building. And the same thing goes with many other sort of groupings, which in fact from a maritime perspective and I think the porosity of the maritime space, the existence of cooperation and competition means also that different forms of unilateral and multilateral formations and manifestations can sit next to each other, and some of them will be exclusive. But what we don't have to let happen is that we forget the value of others' more inclusive type of formats. Like in the Indian Ocean, for example, region, I think IORA has an enormous amount of potential to address certain aspects of human security, particularly like, for example, natural disasters. There is a gender dimension to it because by far the communities and the components that are hit the most by them are women and children, right, and elderly. So in that sense, I love this type of question because it allows all of us to sit down and have a bit of a soul-searching exercise and say, like, yes, in the realities of today, there is the competitive exclusive clubs, but at the same time, there are still all the mechanisms that we started to build over the last 25 years that have not disappeared, and they still represent an opportunity to deal with the plethora of other issues so that we avoid this image perception that we're out there just to do containment. And a maritime domain, contrary to the European environment in which the land domain literally drives separation and boundaries and therefore violations of sovereignty, it's slightly more porous in that respect.
Yes, thanks so much for this. So global and regional order, typically scholars argue that it depends on multilateralism and international treaties. Mm. I think that's definitely the case for maritime. The problem is that the concern is multilateralism is now a recipe for doing nothing, and that we are seeing a breakdown of it. For example, you know, problems with China adhering to UNCLOS tribunal ruling. And so the focus is now on minilaterals. But to what extent do minilaterals actually provoke and make regional order harder to keep together because they exacerbate hierarchy and power? Thanks.
I think you're right. And particularly the qualities of the minilaterals that have emerged are quite different from the multilaterals that have existed previously. So the qualities these days of like Quad is they're exclusive and they're competitive. So they're designed to enhance a competitive dynamic. So their responses to problems of competition. Whereas previously the multilaterals have tried to be inclusive and cooperative. That's to say, trying to drive cooperation and consensus. If you look at the marketplace of ideas, one side's winning and one side's losing, and it's disconcerting. But and even, just as a footnote, even the multilaterals are themselves becoming not forums in which consensus is being built, but places in which the competition is being played out. And that's the slightly depressing component of it.
There is this, I think, this trend towards minilateralism, and that is a defining feature of Indo-Pacific regionalism. And it's a way of coping with this kind of transition between an old order and a new order. There is a glimmer of hope in maritime multilateralism in the negotiation of the new BBNJ, the Biodiversity Beyond National Jurisdiction, or what's sometimes called the High Sea Treaty. While some might argue that that's not really, you know, high politics. I think there are contentious issues that really needed to be worked out, and they deal with some pretty significant resources, on and under the seabed that might become really important for economies. So that might be, you know, a way of saying that multilateralism isn't completely dead, but certainly my concern about minilateralism is the exclusive quality to them. That's, I think, if we want sort of regional buy-in, then, you know, when you've got these countries like Australia, Japan, the United States and India trying to set the agenda, they really, really need to be careful that they're doing it in a way that supports the interests of other states.
I think there's one more just behind you, Matt.
I guess I'll keep it very brief. I'm just wondering in your research and your reporting if there are any lessons to be learned from, say, pre-1914 in Europe, where we saw the great powers, there was significant great power competition, but there was still trading and it had a huge maritime element, the Germans, the French, the British, the Americans for that matter. And also are there lessons learned in like the collapse of a mechanism, the Washington Treaty that was set up in 1922 to try and stabilize the maritime domain in East Asia? Are there lessons that policymakers can learn from those events?
So maritime trade does not prevent war. That's the key lesson. So don't be complacent about it. And I think there is a sort of like a liberal economic theories about maritime interdependence that by, you know, by virtue of its existence, states will not make judgment calls that go against the logic of that interdependence. And I think, you know, that theory is proven sort of having limits on a pretty regular basis. And you wouldn't have war in Ukraine either if that were sort of completely true. And the second point about the naval treaties of the 1920s, you've got, I think, two lessons very important. First of all, don't engage in naval treaties or arms regulatory sort of negotiations unless you have verification systems. Because by 1934, pretty much everybody was cheating around them or trying to find ways to go around them, the Imperial Japanese Navy being at the foremost of that sort of quest. And the second thing is, again, don't rest just on the negotiations as the only place where you try to diffuse lingering tension. And in that sense, we're very lucky because the world of 2024 is a world that is very different. It's not that you have arms regulation sort of negotiation spaces only where the major stakeholders in the maritime domain come together. You have a multiplicity of international, multilateral, minilateral bodies. And in this part of the world, I'd say the thickness of these different layers is by far the greatest down payment into a resiliency that might actually help diffusing escalation beyond the point of control.
Fantastic. I think we are done. Normally, Latrobe Asia tries to hit the deadline. I have singularly failed in my task as my master of ceremonies to keep to a timely deadline for that. I apologize, but I think it's a reflection of the richness of the material, the salience of the topics, and of course the expertise of our panelists. So please join me in thanking Kirko, Beck, and Rachel. It's also to Kate, Matt, and Ray from Latrobe Asia. And thank you very much The brief is here in physical form. It's available electronically. Theo has given you an order, and as La Trobe's Vice Chancellor, it is all of your duties to adhere to this to the letter, which is to sign up for the mailing list and for the podcast. Thanks for coming, and we'll see you at the next event.